Malcolm Honlein is with us. Time for our weekly update. Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Time for the weekly update at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good to be with you as always.
Tough week for a lot of reasons, but maybe for that reason, I want to start with something positive. You've always told us how important it is, not that this is a major revelation, but so important to represent Israel and the Jewish people well and properly. And all of us have a role in doing that, but some people get the opportunity to do so on an international stage. How about a word, Mr. Honlein, about Eden Golan and how she represented both Israel and the Jewish people at Eurovision?
I think it's a cool story and goes beyond her talents as a singer, but her courage, number one, to proceed despite the threats, despite the many roadblocks that were placed in her way, campaign against Israel's participation in Eurovision. And I think under other circumstances, they may have given in, but both she and the sponsors decided to pursue it. And people don't know the contest itself. Many people, it's not something Americans are as aware of as Europeans. Provision, but in Europe, it's followed by many, many millions, and the popular vote placed Israel second. You know, there's a series of votes, and we don't have to go into the details, but when it came then to the final vote, where I think every country gets 12 votes or something like that, or it's proportional, that Israel finished fifth in the competition. Despite the campaign, despite the fact when she sang, they started booing and harassing her, she stood on stage with such poise and such dignity that everybody in Europe was telling me that how people respect her and the dignity she brought Israel. And when she came back, of course, to a hero's welcome, people call her Queen Eidan, but I think it's not, it should be recognized. It takes a degree of heroism for a young woman there alone. And you see her come back pushing her own cart at the airport, which I thought was a great statement after all that she'd been through.
You know, I mean, Eurovision became a big deal for my generation because Israel won it a couple of times. But you're right that there are many people since then who are, especially on this side of the world, who don't follow it. But what's interesting is you mentioned the popular vote, and you have really been on with something of a mantra on a weekly basis here, telling us that what we're seeing in this world is a select group of people. I'm talking about, obviously, the protest demonstrations, those who dare say that Israel is perpetrating genocide, etc., and that the Hamon Am, especially in this country, is really with Israel. The popular vote, I mean, look, if there was a real, you know, Europe-wide boycott, there's no way she would have gotten, you know, the second place in popular vote. Maybe there as well. The very vocal people are very vocal and getting a lot of media attention. And the Hamon Am, so to speak, is, you know, ready to recognize Israel when they feel it deserves to be recognized properly.
I think if I understood this correctly, and it's a very complicated voting system for simple moms like mine, but I think in Ireland, which is about to recognize Palestine, so-called, as a state, that 10 of the 12 initial votes went to Israel. But and this is a country that has been deeply anti-Israel and a lot of anti-Semitism, and I hope you have it. And it's the same thing here. People feel that the campuses are being overrun, which in some instances they are, because of the visibility and the intensity of the demonstrations. But estimates are that it's less than 3% of the population that actually, a campus population that actually joins in these manifestations. And when you ask in all the polls and studies, you ask how many people place this as the critical vote amongst Biden voters, it was, I think, 3 or 4% who made this the primary issue. It is true that there are vocal people who then, you know, do these campaigns not to vote or not to declare and to join in demonstrations. But it doesn't take a lot of people to disrupt. Right. It takes a lot of people to build. And therefore, we take the latter road. At use the former. But I've seen now the polling, which is very contradictory, about the majority want people, want Israel not to continue in Rafah and have appeal for the people who are suffering. But today, there was a meeting of Arab in Bahrain, I think, and Abbas got up and attacked Hamas and said that they're responsible for giving Israelis to go in to Gaza, that their actions are the cause of the destruction and the devastation. Now, that's a very different tone than what we have heard. And I, as I've said often here, that Arab leaders, to a person that I know, say, finish the job. Don't let him get away. Because every time we let this cancer exist, as we did in Lebanon, as we did previously in Gaza, it only comes back, metastasizes in more vicious forms. You see that they regroup even now. Look at the Balia, which they tell me is the worst, the most intense fighting. They're shooting the anti-tank missiles at the Israeli forces and taking a toll, you know, beyond the death toll, which was highly publicized, I think 232, or God willing, doesn't go higher. But there are 15,000 wounded.
Yeah.
And think of the long-term burdens and the costs and the suffering that entails. And yet those guys, the ones is all want to go back to their units, want to fight, understand the mandate that they have and the significance of and the naysayers who join and, you know, who say, well, maybe it's enough, maybe Israel should stop, should look at the map and see what Israel is still facing and will face yet in Rafah and in the other areas, where as soon as you release the area, the cancer comes back to it.
And then on top of that, I mean, you mentioned the numbers, and of course the wounded, and then the trauma and pain of those involved in this week's episode, because this friendly fire episode, and again, we're not here to judge, obviously, and I don't know how much you can analyze what happened for us, but just so tragic and so terrible. And I know it's part of being in a war and these things happen. I get the whole thing, but my gosh, you know, after all these numbers, those killed and those wounded and everything going on for all these months, to have this type of episode happen and affect the families of Israel in the way that it did is just is devastating. Frankly,
it is, and I think you're right to point it out that it's not only the victims' families, but those people who were directly involved, mm-hmm. who carry this burden for the rest of their lives, and you know from American situations of a similar nature, but it's still not the familial relationship that soldiers in Israel feel towards one another. You know, nobody's anonymous. You know, when you shoot, everybody knows who they are, and ultimately everybody has some connection to the families of those people. So I have great rahmanis on them. It's called, it's not excusable. There should be greater controls, but it's not avoidable when you're fighting in such densely populated areas. And look, we still getting more information that the two farm workers were killed, and we have to remember them, and their families suffer as well. From the news that their hopes have been dashed.
No question about it. Last Friday, you laid out for us what you thought would happen at the United Nations later on Friday. Did it go according to what you thought? I mean, the vote certainly was overwhelming in terms of recognizing Palestine and the potential to have it become a real member of the United Nations. Did it go the way you thought? And what are your comments in the aftermath of that episode?
There were no surprises. There are disappointments that countries that didn't vote against granting the status, it doesn't implement it because it has to go to the Security Council. And we have to remember that we rely only on the American veto that things don't go through the Security Council. Too often the Europeans, the British, the French, and others do not stand up to the plate and abstain or even vote for certain resolutions against Israel. And the United States veto is really very critical. Right. The implications, though, of the vote are still serious. It is a recognition. It gives them a voice to the plate. There are some disputes as to whether they can introduce items on the agenda or not. They don't get a vote, but it elevates their status. It gives them a new level of recognition. And they have not earned it. That the people who work against peace and who have not cooperated are getting rewarded again, as we've seen in the past. And that only encourages it there in the Middle East and elsewhere, that the United Nations becomes meaningless. We see in the International Court of Justice now just spent 2 days on hearings against Israel. South Africa to demand that they get out of Gaza right now. And I know people don't know about the court, and it is Byzantine, and I understand all of the confusion. We're all confused as well between the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, and all that. But just believe me, it's not insignificant.
Yeah, that we understand. By the way, on this point, first of all, do you think Abbas said what he said because of last Friday? In other words, he's trying to become more mainstream and, you know, sort of hop on that UN bandwagon from last week, or that's unrelated? And also, second part of the question, is he reflecting the feeling in Judea and Samaria? Because we keep hearing since October 7th how the majority of people, I'm referring, of course, to the Arabs, in Judea and Samaria are supporters of Hamas and liked what they did on October 7th. Is he representing a sort of silent majority, do you think?
So I think maybe the second part answers the first part, that because there are people who, and Hamas has popularity, he's in competition with them.
Right.
They want to take over the West Bank and Yehuda Shomron and replace the PA, in addition, of course, to taking Gaza. So he has a chance now to put them down, to shift the onus onto them, not their, and not the failures of the people to exercise control and to have abandoned Gaza and to, you know, because they were in control there, that and the ineffectual job that they're doing now and the lack of real security control, as evidenced by every time Israel goes into one of the places in Tulkarem or Ramallah, any place, and discover huge caches of weapons and the infrastructure that's there. It's not the PA forces that are doing it. It's Israeli forces in most cases. So that's one. Two, I think he knows the mood of the participants there on whom he's dependent. They get a lot of money out of some of the countries that are there. And I think he was playing to them and to the West to say, you know, that I'm a diplomatic alternative. I'm the more sane alternative to Hamas. And one makes a pitch for support by attacking them. But, you know, he also played a role in enabling them.
Understood. Did the United States, in fact, hold back information, intelligence that could have helped Israel in terms of finding Sinwar and other Hamas leaders?
As of yesterday's briefings and things that the remarks and messages that top officials have said, the answer is no. They say they did not withhold and would not withhold such important information like the presence of the places where the hostages are being held or where the leadership of Hamas is located.
And last week we discussed, of course, how angry many of us were and are about President Biden's announcement regarding arms to Israel. Yet this week it looked like there was more approval of different types of arms shipments. Could you give us an update on what the U.S. is and is not doing in that regard right now?
So again, this is very complicated. Why? Because you have so many layers in terms of the arms sales to Israel. Delivery dates could be now, could be in 2 years, 3 years, some of the stuff, you know, over a period of years to ship it and for Israel actually to take delivery. But in the package they were announced, new, it was previously approved. It does not include the 500 and 2,000 pound bomb. It's what the president put the hold on. So these are other munitions needed, and Israel needs to bulk up, not so much, they say, for Gaza, where they claim to have enough in their stockpiles to carry, to execute the conflict there, but anticipating by Hezbollah, which will require a much stronger response, a much greater special aerial response because of the terrain, because of the scope of what we're talking about, and the 150,000 missiles in their hands, and seeing this week how they have affixed a bomb, a drone, a more advanced bomb that was able to penetrate into Israel and fire the missile, which hit a sensitive place. That, of course, has to escalate Israel's response and Israel's alert about what Hamas is, what Hezbollah is capable of doing, and why they have to move to try to preempt by hitting the launchers and hitting the specific sites where weapons are located. Ultimately, many people believe they will have to go in to force them back to the Litani or 10 kilometers from the border. Remember, 100,000 people are still homeless in the north, or 80,000, according to some estimates. But regardless, the businesses, I just spoke to somebody who owns a winery there, a very popular one, well-known to your audience, and it's destroyed. It was burnt. And he told me it will take 3 years to replant and regrow vines and have the grapes back. People don't think of the economic impact on families that and businesses that have not functioned now since last October. And many of the houses have been damaged by the firing those anti-rockets in particular, but others as well. And so this front, which did not get enough attention, it will get much more now if Hezbollah continues to escalate and the need for effective response. To go back to your question, so the answer is that weapons are continuing to flow beyond the $1 billion package that the president announced, but the bombs were still not approved.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course on the beloved NSN app. Any hopes of a relatively immediate hostage deal? No chance. It sounded last week like it was not imminent, but that there was, you know, it was in play, so to speak. Now it seems, based on media reports, that at the moment there's not much hope. Agreed or not?
There's always hope, but there's no right now reality.
Right.
Once they have gone back, you know, in Egypt, there are people there talking again. But, you know, Hamas keeps raising its demands, and they're demanding, and they're talking about the return of bodies, live or dead, which Israel certainly can't accept. And they're asking for large numbers of people to be released and to do it over a very long, extended period. The only answer is when we start really reaching the top leadership, when Sinwar is killed, when others are eliminated, then... And again, most of the countries in the West agree with this. Despite their criticism, they want these guys gone too. Yeah. But right now, I don't think any real deal is imminent.
And if the United States says we're going to hold, even though the pier is now completed, we're going to hold off on providing humanitarian aid in bulk through that pier until the hostages are released. It's irrelevant because, honestly, Sinwar couldn't care less about the humanitarian aid that's supposed to come in, right?
He takes his share, and he sends his guys to take over the trucks. They abscond with a lot of it. They sell the rest. They're the ones who are violating humanitarian law, and yet they no criticism. You hear all of this, the parade of workers from or representatives of the aid agencies. Sure, there's a holdup, and the demonstrators have delayed some of the shipments, but that isn't the core of the problem. And again, there does not appear to be starvation in Gaza. Are there areas which have need more, don't have food, or because of the terrorism that's ongoing, you can bring them in? But they can walk, they can go a short distance, and they will be able to find food. And many of the markets you see have plenty of food in them. In various areas of Gaza, so the story is distorted and misrepresented to a large degree. There are problems; people are forced to move, and 500,000 people or more have left left Rafah area already. And you know it's a refugee situation that is difficult. There are families that are moving, but at least their lives are not being threatened. They're being moved for their safety, while the responsible party is the fact that Hamas embeds themselves in civilian populations and uses them as human shields. That stops. Everybody goes home.
Yeah, understood. You think the Rafah operation is going to become more of a full-scale one? I think everyone on this side of the world, especially in the media, is confused whether Israel actually has, you know, started its full-scale Rafah operation or not. Do you think things are going to heat up over the next few days?
I do think that it will escalate. I think Israel's still trying to do it in a controlled fashion. There's no carpet bombing. There's no attempts of, you know, just to destroy. They're going after targeted areas. But as we know, Hamas builds this very intense infrastructure, which gives them resiliency also, that you see they can reestablish quickly, even in areas where they did fight. In the Jabalia case, this was an area of the camp which they did, Israel didn't go into previously. So they stocked up and they had all the weapons that they had there were still intact. In Rafah, it's the question is the leadership there? Is the leadership, as some say, back in Khan Yunis or still in Khan Yunis? And where are the hostages? So Israel has to weigh each of these things using maximum intelligence. It's very easy to criticize when a mistake happens or, you know, to talk about the policy. But it's such an intricate war and it's so complicated and the spirit of the troops is so amazing and the courage and the heroism. I mean, every day, virtually every soldier is a hero of the Jewish people.
No doubt about that. Any idea percentage-wise what percentage of soldiers / reservists are up north compared to who's either near or in Gaza? Do we have any idea what the statistic is on that?
There are various numbers, but troops have been shifted back and forth. I think it's probably for security reasons they don't.
I'm asking because it seems to be much more significant up north than we originally thought, and that's, you know, obviously Israel has been anticipating that there could, God forbid, be serious action. I don't know why I'm saying it like that. There has been serious action up north, and there have been terrible sacrifices that have been made, including this episode that happened overnight. But the rumor I heard this week is that arrangements are being made by the government to give the option to residents of the north to stay out of the north and in hotels and other facilities around Israel until December. Now, if that's true, Malcolm, I think at some point we have to admit that, you know, I'm not saying that Hezbollah conquered the north, but boy, you know, they came as close as possible to doing so if their goal was, in fact, to, you know, chase away Israelis. In fact, I would assume that aside from, you know, maybe couples and smaller families that are thinking of going up north, you know, larger families from there have had to have gone somewhere and made arrangements for themselves to start their lives over somewhere else. Am I overstating this, or is there, you know, somewhat of a Hezbollah victory up there?
So just this morning, there were many Iron Dome interceptions over Katsrin, over other areas, and over the communities near to the Lebanon border. This is ghost town area. Even big cities, you know, have been devastated. Kiryat Shmona, others that are on the border, that doesn't get the attention that the Gaza situation were the major conflict, but everybody knew that this was an open front, and there had always been harassment, and we know there were tunnels that were built. There were the investment by Iran is much greater in Lebanon than it was in Gaza with Hezbollah, that is, and they have very sophisticated equipment. That's why Israel constantly carried out, in fact, thousands of raids in places in Syria and elsewhere to stop the shipments and transfer precision guidance systems and others to upgrade the over 100,000, maybe 150,000 projectiles that Hezbollah has in the north. Iran doesn't want to see it wiped out. Iran wants to use that as leverage against Israel to ever strike its nuclear capacities. And this is their ace in the in their hands that they can attack Israel. But it is escalating. Israel's had to respond multiple times a day, but the number of attacks across the border, across Israel's border into the north, have increased, and they penetrated this week pretty far into Israel with a drone. And there are questions about why, whether Israel just let it go because it knew it would fall in an unpopulated area. But it hit a balloon that is used for surveillance on the ground. So the situation there is escalating. People know that they have been told that they won't be getting back probably till after the summer, whether it'll be September, October, December. We don't know. I mean, it's they prepare for it. Many are still in hotels and have been in them now for all of these months. Think of the disruptions to the kids, to the education, to the families, and giving them advance notice at least allows them to prepare and to arrange schooling, to arrange, you know, to how they work and whatever
The larger families, based on anecdotal evidence, the larger families are literally going other places and starting their lives over because, like you just said, they've got to get a stable situation for their kids. They don't have they don't have the patience required to, you know, keep the kids around and wonder what's going to happen month to month.
But think of all the businesses in this, what I said, if you can't move the vines, you know, and it's a great area for growing grapes and amazing wines that have come. But there are many industries in the North that have not functioned and people can't function. They don't have access to their homes. It's really terrible.
And look, from a military standpoint, families have been able to go back to their cities in the South along the Gaza envelope, so to speak. They're not able to do it in the North. And what's the difference? And unfortunately, the difference is that, you know, look at the damage that Israel has done and the threat that they are, the serious threat that they are to Hamas and Gaza in general. And that, you know, under that military act, under the cover of military action, people have been able to go back home. It looks like if it's going to happen up North and by the end of 2024, people are really going to go back home up North, they're likely going to have to do something similar, no?
That or reach some sort of accord or hope that the as Hezbollah said, if the fighting stops in Gaza, they will stop. But it exposes the infrastructure under long-term danger. So I think there are people who will not go back. I think many are committed to doing so. They love their life in the North, and it was beautiful for the most part. They always lived, you know, under the threat. But again, they're courageous people. And we can't afford to give in because there's only going to be an incentive for them to the other side to do more. Because if they see they can depopulate the area on the border, they will try all the time to take it. They will try broaden that the scope of the area that is depopulated. So you can't give in to that because the terrorists, they thrive on it. Hamas and Hezbollah thrive when the areas down there were depopulated. And now you see that they continue to fire. This week in Sderot, they had three times alarms went off, alerts went off, and thank God Fire Dome and other things that many of the rockets were taken out and many land in the areas not where they don't do damage, but it's not over. And you know, the terrorists somehow have this ability because it doesn't take much to launch a rocket from there. You know, you put the thing in a tube and you fire it, and Israel takes it out, but it's a two-bit operation. And Israel, each time they fire in the Iron Dome, it costs them $100,000.
Unbelievable. All right, we got to get your comment regarding Russia and China. Big week for the two countries with this summit among their leaders. What do you think of what happened between the two countries this week?
Well, it's interesting that it's Putin, after his, quote, re-election in a very fair and democratic election in Russia, made his showcase visit to China because they're dependent on China. They need Chinese weapons for Ukraine. The economic conditions in Russia are terrible. Not that in China they're great, but they have formed an alliance against the United States. And the Iranians are part of it. Others are in that orbit. They are escalating the show of unity as an increased threat. The message because of American warships in near Taiwan or other provocations, according to the Chinese, which are really just defensive measures and trying to prevent an escalation there. But we have to look at how that alliance is changing, how the BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Council are expanding in their influence. And most of all this week, in terms of China, the revelations that it's Chinese Communist Party money, which I alluded to earlier in the earlier broadcast, that is behind the demonstrations and paying for the demonstrations on our campuses. They're trying to destabilize America, and they are infiltrating people into the country. They are paying for this through a businessman in Hong Kong who serves as the conduit, but a lot of money, and Qatar obviously has poured in the bulk of billions into campus, not investment money. I'm talking about destabilizing money on our campuses. But now it's China that has taken the lead on this, and the implications that people understand now that it's Israel is just the excuse. America is the target. That's what the, what these are about. They're anti-American. Listen to the messages that they say. They are not new messages. We've heard them before. But their goal is to destroy America as we know it.
Wow. So, I mean, you always point this out. So many fronts we have to be concerned about regarding the U.S. and Israel. So many potential enemies and enemies out there. Two things from Israel this week to get your comments about. First of all, there was actually a demonstration, a march from Sderot to the Gaza border. The point is to make a big deal about the potential reclamation, the resettling of the Gaza Strip. I mean, do you think this is going to become a big movement now in Israel?
To resettle
the Gaza Strip?
It's a very limited movement. It's not, Israel won't allow it. It's also now for sure a bigger security risk. There are people who want to revise history and not revisionist, not for rampant, but to show that it was a mistake to pull out of Gaza, that look, the price we're paying. Historians and others will analyze this for many years to come. We don't know what would have happened had the communities been allowed to stay, what price they would have paid, whether this could have prevented the importation of the weapons and the situation from degrading to what it is. But, you know, the both in the north and the south, we face, a little country is facing so much. I think this morning there were 75 rockets fired in the north from Lebanon at Israel in one part of the morning. The south had multiple experiences of it. It's such a huge challenge. So spending time now saying what if in terms of the past, there is a group that they've gone to the border. They have demonstrated it's not going to happen. The government of Israel won't allow it to happen. Certainly in Gaza, it won't allow it. But it's a attempt to focus attention on what happens when you give up territory and you withdraw. Yeah. But I don't want to say, but we are strong. People should not be depressed. I was in Five Towns in Young Israel, Woodmere. I saw a packed house. People are committed. People are there. We have to see ourselves. We can take them on. You see that on the campuses now. Our people are being held to account where we stand up, and we have many allies in non-Jewish communities. The Christian movements are mobilizing on this as well. We will not become depressed. That's what the enemy wants to do to us. We have to feel revitalized and re-energized and be resilient, which is the code word for Jews throughout all of history.
Well, the real question is, are all those people showing up to these programs and lectures, are they participating in what you've been recommending, which is to advocate on behalf of Israel and on behalf of the hostages? I mean, now it's easy. We said this earlier in the week. Now it's easy through email to reach these government officials, someone's senator, someone's congressperson, obviously the White House. I mean, I'm hoping that all this, translates into action on behalf of Israel and on behalf of the hostages.
Well, I had the opportunity to speak to a group of the, quote, influencers in the Jewish community, and I saw myself with some tweet I put out and got thousands and thousands of responses. People want to do, they need to be guided on what to do. They, NORPAC, takes people to Washington. We should have ongoing presence in Washington. People have to be there. But what I'm hearing, and Nachum, it's at a time when I'm very depressed, and it happens a lot these days, to see amazing people emerging, undertaking things on their own, young people, business people, older people who were not part of the organized community necessarily, or even considered, pro-Israel activists or active in pro-Israel activities, are now joining it. They're starting initiatives of all kind online, in person, establishing new initiatives. It's very encouraging, and you see a lot of young people in these efforts. So while, of course, it's the bleak things that get the attention, we should not be dissuaded when we see hundreds of people going to Washington in a week, when we see the need for constant presence. People should go informed, make a case, fight for the legislation now about holding universities to account to expose the foreign funding. They don't report the money they're getting. We've identified $13 billion in money from Arab countries that they don't account for. $6.5 billion probably just from Qatar, and let alone now the Chinese money. Universities got away with it. They're supposed to report anything over $250,000. Now there's new law to make it over $50,000. You have the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. We have the Student Protection Act. We have many pieces of legislation. They need to hear from us. They need to see that they support it, and that the leaders, and especially in the Senate and the Democrats, have to hear from us as consistently as possible about where we stand.
Yeah, and I hope your passion for this continues to rub off on all of them and all of us. Thank you so much, Mr. Homeline. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week.
Good Shabbos, be well.
Malcolm Homeline, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations.